Monday, June 12th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Joey Chestnut pulled a reverse DeSantis by standing tall and not banning a book. No one knows. The governor of Florida banned fake meat. Remember that. And yesterday, actual meat company Nathan's Hot Dogs banned Chestnut, 16-time hot dog eating champion, from their July 4th competition because he endorsed fake meat. Nathan's and Major League Eating says the greatest competitive eater of all time violated their ban on endorsing a rival meat company. Isn't that exactly the point of Beyond Meat, that they're not meat, i.e. Beyond Meat? Those arguments are beyond the good people who run the hot dog eating contest. While this does open the door for such gustinary stalwarts as Eric Badlands Booker, a number 3 ranked competitive eater Nick Wary, married to number 1 ranked women's competitive eater Mickey Sudo, it does shut one door. Nathan Hot Dog Eating Champion announcer and Major League Eating Chairman George Shea used to introduce Joey Chestnut at the contest like this.
In a world of nothing, of barren hills and cracked earth and once proud oceans drained to sand, there will still be a monument to our existence, bleached by the sun perhaps and blunted by time, but everlasting. Because this man represents all that is...
Yes, this is an intro for a guy who's going to eat a lot of hot dogs. But when I say a lot, I speak not in terms of quantities or counting numbers, but of ideas and creeds. For as the humble carpenter ant was put on this earth to build, as the leaf exists to photosynthesize, so too does this man live, nay, exist to consume. The Taco Bell soft-shell beef tacos champion, the deep-fried asparagus-eating champion, a man who, in devouring more than 121 Twinkies in 6 minutes, became, scientists say, a being made of more creamy goodness than muscle and sinew, I give you your champion, Joey Chestnut! I have, over the years, and in fact it was in like one two-day session, tracked down every George Shea intro to every Joey Chestnut competition, not just Nathan's, ice cream eating contests, tamale eating contests. This is, and I think if you know me, I believe this to be the apotheosis of communications. I love these things, and now no more. The hot dog goes uneaten, the bun is bare, the relish gives lie to its eager sobriquet. Joey Chestnut may endorse Beyond Meat, but it is beyond me how easily greatness and destiny can be cleaved by the insertion of an agent in the stroke of a fountain pen. I hope it's worth it to all involved. I, for one, will not forget the comet that shone bright, the colon that closed tight. The Elvis of eating has left the building. The cylindrical meat product is at half mast. Joey Chestnut has been denied a seat at the table. Well, we pick up the pieces, we move on. On the show today, I am a little congested about pricing. But first, the greatest Dallas sports talk radio show isn't on the radio. What? The Hang Zone was a big hit on local station The Ticket, hosted by Dan McDowell and Jake Kemp. The two parted ways with the station and hung a shingle as a podcast to be called The Dumb Zone. The station tried to enforce a non-compete clause, and they would have gotten away with it if it weren't for that pesky Biden administration's FTC ban on non-compete clauses. Or at least these two guys, these Dumb Zone podcasters, are the poster children for that effort. Labor law, free commerce, and Luka Doncic talk up next.
Out here in the fields, I fight for my meals. I get my back into my living.
You are about to enter the Dumb Zone. Fans of The Gist will say, what's different? Well, this is titularly the Dumb Zone. It is the Patreon podcast hosted by Dan McDowell and Jake Kemp. What an interesting story they had. The two were one of the most popular shows on The Ticket, which is a Dallas area sports radio show. And as contracts do, it came up and there was some tension, there was some disagreement, they couldn't come to terms. This always happens. So these two talkers with a built-in audience left, and they wanted to do essentially what I'm doing, talk outside the auspices of a broadcast studio. No, said their old bosses, and now I shall read from a Washington Post article, and I do this for two reasons. They put it out there in grandiose terms, but also, I don't know with non-disclosures if Dan and Jake could admit to this, but at stake, right? This is them leaving the ticket. At stake is not just the future of the co-host's musings about the Dallas Cowboys schedule and Disney casting controversies, but also the status of millions of other workers across the country affected by non-compete clauses. Jake Kemp, Dan McDowell, welcome to The Gist, and thank you on behalf of the workers of America.
Thank you. I was a long-time hang-up and listen listener.
Oh, good. Did we teach you anything you had to unlearn?
No, I don't think so. It was it was kind of laid back. Big Stefan fan, so yeah, I was a regular consumer of that podcast. It was early in the game.
Yeah, that podcast started out early, and still going from what I understand, though. What is that all? What is that all joke? She's still doing it, just not with me. So that was Jake.
Country
you heard
song
from.
Or something.
Yeah. So that was Jake you just heard from. Dan, how are you? Thank you on behalf of every worker of America. Do you think that thanks is warranted?
That absolutely. That's what we did it for. We're very selfless. We're all about the people.
Some might say heroes, but that's up. We leave that up to the people.
Yeah.
Here's another phrase from that Washington Post article. The hosts of a podcast could transform U.S. labor law. Now, I want to ask you, were you thinking, all right, if the Post wants to write that and say that, it helps? Or were you thinking that even if it is grandiose and putting you in the center of things, that maybe it's a little true? The could part?
I suppose could. We were probably focused on just our own paper in front of us. And yes, if the Post wants to write a bunch of stuff, cool. That's not going to hurt in the long run. Maybe we can get a follower or two or a subscriber or two. But, I don't know the impact. I mean, hey, they had that ruling this year on non-competes. Is that a coincidence? It's absolutely a coincidence. They had been working on that for a long time before that.
Really, I think part of the way that it happened, and Dan's completely right, we were not on any grand crusade from our perspective, but what happened was once you start in a contract negotiation or dispute or whatever you might want to term it, you have lawyers look at your agreement, and multiple lawyers looked at our agreement, which I think are probably pretty standard across this industry, and said, this is not enforceable and it is way, way too broad. That the way that the contract was structured was just something that they felt that if a judge looked at this, they would say, how are you getting away with this? And that's essentially exactly what happened. So that's really when we became aware that it was something bigger than just, hey, we might be taking our career in a different direction. But I would not say that that was like the genesis of it.
Right.
Yeah, not enforceable, but then, who's going to fight it?
Yeah.
And we didn't mean to get in the fight. We got sued. So we had to, go to court and go to a hearing. But, we weren't trying to, like Jake said, go on this crusade. The way they kind of have their thumb on everybody, though, is like, well, you're not – even when we talk to lawyers, look, if you want to fight this, it's probably going to be pretty expensive. It's going to take a long time. Are you in for that? And I would guess most employees of radio companies are like, no.
Or any company.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty much the gist of it.
See, thank you. These guys are professionals. They call themselves the Dumb Zone, but you heard the skill at play there. So standard in our industry, or our old industries, is it is standard and proper, and you can understand why, say, a radio station or employer would say, if you are poached by some other entity, we don't want you on the air against us for a set number of times, right? If you break your contract, or perhaps you could even say if you break your contract, you're not able to work for us, right? If you are a designer for Google, within the next 3 months, you can't take all our technology. There's a cooling off period if you go work for Meta. Stuff like that is fine. Or enforceable, I would say. Whatever the status of your contract with your old station was broader than that. But what I want to know is, was it broader? Would it have been broader 5-10 years ago? Or was it actually a function of what the new Biden administration is bringing to bear on non-compete clauses? Did the new administration have any effect on your negotiation?
I think it can be both at the same time. The contracts, what is... Actually, the inverse happened. They continued to get broader and more restrictive every single time we came up for a contract negotiation. And I got the sense, and this may still be the case, that a lot of these companies still think that potential ruling is a paper tiger. I still don't think that they think it's actually going to affect them. And you know, the judge that was on our hearing and our ultimately helped us mediate our settlement. It was a Trump appointee. You know, it wasn't like she was some far left, you know, labor crusader again. So, and then our position, which you're right, I get you can't take the formula for Coke and go over to Pepsi and tell them exactly how it works a week later. But our position was essentially that the business of the radio station was advertising. We didn't go work for another radio station, and we intentionally did not do advertising out of the gate. You know, we were behind a paywall. So our position was that the customer that buys the ad is your customer, right? Not just the listener. And ultimately, that's something that the court basically agreed with. We continued to not do advertising until our predetermined non-compete expired. We played by those rules. And I really think that had they just thought about it a little bit harder, rather than reacting emotionally and out of anger, everything could have been a lot smoother.
And I would think a company would try to do whatever they can to define things as broadly as possible. And they were maybe saying, your business is talking into a microphone. But I wonder if any of these rulings touched on the idea that radio is different from podcasting. I'm sure your old company said they're doing the same thing. And you're saying, especially because you weren't even involved in advertising-based podcasting, well, maybe it seems or appears to the ear somewhat similar, but they're really different things.
Yeah, that's exactly what they tried to say. And you talk about contracts 5-10 years ago, because I worked at the ticket for 20, Jake for 10. So, yes, I'm very familiar with how those contracts were. And it used to say, specifically, if you are competing would mean a terrestrial radio station within the Dallas-Fort Worth area market. So it didn't even say a terrestrial radio station, because there was never a distinction.
Right.
It was just a radio station.
Right. It's like day baseball pre-1935. It was just baseball.
Yeah. I believe Jake signed a new contract. You know, my last contract was 5 years ago. Jake's was like 2 years ago. And then in Jake's, they kind of added a word, or podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it was terrestrial radio or podcasting. Mine did not say that. And that was part of the question mark as we went into this hearing together. Our contracts were slightly different. But the contract they were offering us now, this year, when we went through this, was or podcasting or video streaming or, and then it literally said, any technology that is not out there at this point yet, but will be developed in the next 5 years.
Yes.
So they were just trying to cover themselves totally for, like you said, if our voice is used anywhere, they own us. And we thought we were getting paid to do a 3-hour radio show. So anything outside of that is not competing, and we should be able to do those things as well. They disagreed.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I've always written. I used to write for The Athletic. I write Mavs and Cowboys stuff for D Magazine here in town now. And my point when discussing this with like their top counsel was, we're in the attention business. So if you don't have a problem with me writing a 2,000-word article that probably I would imagine you're not going to be listening to the radio station while you try to consume, then you've already basically conceded the point that there are things that we should be and that you've permitted us to do that ostensibly could take somebody away from listening nonstop to the radio station. And they just didn't see it that way.
Yeah, yeah. There are First Amendment implications, and First Amendment rights can be signed away and are often signed away, and employers enforce laws or rules against employees who are allowed to speak by the government, just are not allowed to say the things they say with employers. But it also does get to, obviously, businesses want to have an expansive definition of and control their workers, or I guess former workers, as much as they can. I also think, but Jake, you tell me, the ethic in newspapering or writing is dying, and maybe some of the top columnists in a day when the Daily News or the New York Post used to fight for Mike Lupica, maybe there would be some non-competes, but in general, it would be antithetical to just the nature of print to say you can't write, you can't be a journalist somewhere else. But radio doesn't look at things like that. I don't get the sense that it does.
No, no, you're definitely correct about that. And see, the other point kind of related to that was we always thought if we do more things outside of just noon to three on the ticket, that's only going to help grow our noon to three presence, you know? So I think me writing helps the show and helps the station. I think if Dan did a video stream every afternoon after the show, I think it would help the station. I think they look at it as it's basically all like zero sum, and I just never really saw it that way. The other thing I forgot to mention with regard to how we first sort of found out about some of this labor stuff, and I just thought of it when you mentioned their desire to control the employee. We were told multiple times throughout the years that we were not allowed in any circumstance to discuss our compensation with our fellow employees. Most of us did. But once they said that, and I told a lawyer that, that lawyer said, that is patently illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, they found that out. But that was kind of the vibe, the culture was, nobody talk about your contract with anybody else. The obvious reason being, because if Dan found out that X employee who was doing the same job made X more, he would have an issue with that. And that might have been when the ball first started getting rolling on lawyers telling us, like, hey, I don't think they're playing completely above board here.
Yeah. It's also crazily unenforceable since I assume that plenty of guys at the station had the same agent. So they're going to know what everyone's compensation is.
For sure.
And so, like, how do you not communicate? Would it be a violation of communication for you to write the number down, but instead of a 7, you use, like, an S sign, spell Kesha with a dollar sign? Like, what would technically be a violation of this unenforceable clause? It's hilarious. Is it?
Yeah.
Do you think it's, I don't know, what's the state of sports talk radio? You could say, well, these are the tactics that a strong company uses, able to strong arm its employees. Or is it more like the death knell of a dying industry?
I personally, I'm still of the opinion that talk radio will survive because I have Sirius XM, you know, or I have podcasts or I have my phone. I also have two kids that are, you know, around the age of 20. And they've never turned on the radio. They will just instantly go to Spotify or whatever. So I do see that. And as far as music, why would I ever listen to a local music station when they're going to have a 5-minute, 8-minute spot set?
Because well, I can have Sirius. If you know the phrase, the pay is you could get a free beer koozie. I mean, that's one.
I do love that. But I do believe the local talk will survive. I think the pie, the overall radio pie is shrinking, but I think local talk, I think their share will actually grow of that pie in the long run. That's my opinion. So I don't think the industry is dying, I guess, the whole industry of radio, but I think local talk will remain. Just like the industry of, you know, network TV is dying, like it's way different than it was in the 80s, but sports, that's still the one thing that of the smaller pie, it's still got the biggest piece. So I kind of think local talk, it's, you know, it's different than podcasting too. You know, even a local podcast like we are, it doesn't have the immediacy. If something goes down right now, If Dirk decides to go back to the Mavs and help lead them to the title this year, we can't jump on right now and you tune in live to hear what we have to say. So I think there's a lot. I think there is a lot to local talk radio.
And now our big local sports segment, Game 3 of the NBA Finals. The Mavericks, as you guys admitted, will not be winning the NBA Finals. The question is, can they win a game or two? Here is my question. I'm watching some deep round of the playoffs, and the Mavs are overperforming. And I think it's Stan Van Gundy pronounces, this is the most, was it talented, explosive? I think it was explosive backcourt in NBA history. And I immediately dismissed it because how could we not have noticed this until now? And I immediately thought of Steph and Clay, but I think statistically they might be right. My question for you is just that first question. How are we first noticing it now that there's a plausible case that Kyrie Irving and Luka Doncic are the most explosive backcourt in NBA history? Take it.
Well, last year after the deadline was a disaster because they could never really get on the same page. Luka carries such a load that he doesn't really practice much. He's hurt all the time because he's got he just takes a beating. So Luka was hurt, then Kyrie was hurt, then Luka was hurt. Then they had a couple of fluky games where they were really good together, but they would lose in the clutch. And my hope as a fan, frankly, was if they just get a full training camp and a full offseason together, that things will come along a little bit. And it started out decent, but really a biggest thing was when they made the trades this year and the signings they made this year, it allowed Luka and Kyrie, one, to get a little help, but also not to be exposed so badly as a pretty poor defensive backcourt. I know Luka's numbers this year defensively are good, but I'm not a huge fan of NBA individual defensive numbers. I think they can be a lot fluky, really. So that's a big part of it. And then, you know, I would say people around here have noticed that the two of them, when they're cooking, can play as well as any backcourt ever. I would still take Steph and Clay, especially if you add in defense, but they work really, really well together, and that was something that I would say the overwhelming majority of people here last year did not believe was ever going to happen. I mean, the Mavericks re-signed Kyrie basically because they had no choice. They were so far over the cap. They had lost Brunson for nothing. He was basically the only guy they could bring back. And it was a weird situation where nobody else wanted to sign Kyrie for that number either. So they both had like zero and all of the leverage at the same time. But yeah, I think they can win a game, but Luka's beat up and the Celtics are a machine. So
I thought that same thing when you said the Stan Van Gundy declarative statement was, I think it was the most talented offensive backcourt in NBA history. And that's a classic sports talk debate because, really, what did he say? You know, is he saying the best backcourt?
Like, he might even have thrown in arguably.
That's now,
a fantastic commentator move.
And yes, and then the sports world picked that up, and then let's do it on all the shows, and let's and it's
well,
perfect
because
Steph
proving
and Clay,
his point because everyone argued about it, so he doesn't have to be right. You just have to argue about it.
Yeah, and the Steph and Clay, you know, full resume and four titles, and you know, all NBA teams and all that. Okay, yeah, that's going to take a while for Luka and Kyrie to get there. But yeah, they're just individually, they're both pretty explosive, talented offensively. So here we go. We're in the sports argument.
Okay. That is the fade, a version of the fade. And when I do the fade, I annoy some in my audience, but I suspect many a Gist listener will be saying now, I'm okay without the deep dive into defending the high pick and roll, but some want it, some need it, and we're going to give it. Pesca Plus subscribers get bonus episodes. They also get all episodes with no ads. If you just want no ads but no bonus episodes, there's a price point for that too. A few tiers of membership to honor the tiers of Mavericks fans should the team go down 3-0. You can try our offer free for 7 days, hear all of this, delve into the back catalog, all the other Pesca Plus goodies. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. If you don't reside in New York, maybe you haven't heard of the now aborted congestion pricing scheme. Maybe you have heard of it because you're a curious citizen of the world, or because all the media that does reside in New York make sure you knew it happened, or didn't happen. So a quick summary. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo and then Mayor of New York Bill de Blasio both agreed in principle to a plan that would charge cars to use the streets of New York below 60th Street. The real decision maker wasn't de Blasio or his successor, Eric Adams. It is the governor of New York and the current New York governor, Kathy Hochul, who was the one with final approval over this plan, assumed office and she was on board. She campaigned on it. She was elected supporting it. She touted congestion pricing's benefits. And they were A, this toll would raise money. That was absolutely true. B, it would decrease car traffic. C, it would combat climate change. That part was a little bit oversold, but it would be slightly beneficial in terms of emissions. D, it would allow mass transit to flow smoother. Yes, for buses, meh, for subways. And E, it would soak only rich drivers, which was totally overstated. But also, let's consider F, it would show that New York City can do big things. USA, NYC. Then, at the very last minute, New York Governor Kathy Hochul canceled the plan, didn't give really great reasons, and the entire scheme, to many a dream, was dead. Here are political experts from the local news station New York One analyzing the governor's decision.
Some of Kathy Hochul's public statements over the last couple of years, you know, she's talking about how we can't give in to fear and, you know, we have to fight the opposition, and then that's kind of exactly what she did at the 11th hour.
And she blinked.
They were nicer than most. The real reason that Hochul backtracked was that the plan was unpopular in the New York suburbs, where people drive into Manhattan and don't want to pay for that. And she, as a Democrat, was alerted by Chuck Schumer and Representative Hakeem Jeffries that the elected Democratic officials who were holding on to congressional seats in those suburban areas were vulnerable, hated the plan, would blame her. Voters would punish Democrats. Who would they elect? Well, not literally George Santos, he's not going to get reelected, but the same spirit that swept that nudnik into office might help a Republican who really was on the Baruch College volleyball team or some other credit that Santos claimed that wasn't true. So this Hochul flip-flop, backtrack, last-minute reversal was assailed by media, business leaders, environmentalists, and longtime New York Times columnists who asked in one headline, "What made New York great? Leadership. Where is it now?" Hochul probably read that column because she phrased her answer to the tough question, hey, why the last minute reversal, in the exact terms presented.
Leaders sometimes need to listen more, and I realize that.
As this no one is buying it. I listen. No, I listen to the answer. It's not true. But I am thinking about leadership, and I am thinking about the leader who Kathy Hochul took over from, Andrew Cuomo. For all his flaws, would he have budged? Michael Kimmelman, the Times writer behind that column, wrote the first positive assessment of anything Cuomo did in the New York Times over the last 3 years. He wrote, "Hochul's predecessor, Andrew Cuomo, channeled his inner Robert Moses, made it a priority to rebuild LaGuardia Airport without having to shut it down. It was an astonishing act of chutzpah and feat of structural engineering. Cuomo also pushed to turn a Midtown post office building with a facade by Charles McKim into a soaring new gateway for Amtrak passengers called Moynihan Train Hall. Then he resigned in disgrace." I think Andrew Cuomo would not have been intimidated out of dragging the congestion pricing plan over the finish line. But it's complicated, and this is, if you have been covering this, you're probably screaming, Andrew Cuomo's against congestion pricing. Yes, he did come out against congestion pricing this year. He did it because he wanted to get on the opposite side of an issue that was politically unpopular from Kathy Hochul. He still harbors ambitions to rerun for office. He sees himself as a champion of those suburban voters slash drivers who would be effective. He's instinctively against most leftist slash progressive Democratic ideas. All true, but let's also defer to Ross Barkin, who's pretty much the best New York City political writer going. He puts it this way. The difference between Hochul and Cuomo is they both could do bad governance and 11th-hour reversals without telling anyone, but Cuomo understood how to wield power and not look weak. If he wanted congestion pricing dead, he would have done it months or years ago. And I don't think he would have wanted congestion pricing dead. It was so associated with his legacy, or would have been by now. He'd have gotten it passed. He'd have taken the hits. He'd have been able to stand up to more powerful Democrats, of whom he would deny the premise, and say, no, I'm doing this. This will be my legacy. I think he certainly understood the optics of not looking weak, but he could also wield power. And wielding power is an inherent act of resolve. I don't see how you could do it effectively if you're not willing to be tough. Toughness does come in many forms, but I firmly, resolutely, here are some synonyms of toughness, believe that Kathy Hochul didn't show it. Now, of course, dumb toughness or a headstrong commitment to bad policy is bad, obviously, but there are very, very few political accomplishments worth pursuing that don't involve toughness, which might mean meanness. It often does, which does connote the willingness and ability to punish one's enemies and reward one's friends. I think about this because I think of a conversation that the New York journalist, New York Magazine journalist, Rebecca Traister, who is one of the people writing about Andrew Cuomo and through her journalism, chasing him from office. She was on the Brian Lehrer show, and she talked about the entire nature of toughness and governance. I played a clip before, small clip of that. I'll play a longer clip now. And I thought about it, and I thought at the time I listened to it, well, she's wrong. Maybe in this moment it seems like the right thing to say, but her premise is off. She's not offering good examples of the world she's envisioning actually being the world we inhabit. And I've yet to see examples that someone with this argument could point to saying, there, do it like that. And we just saw a pretty huge counterexample. We see it all the time. So here now is that argument about rethinking toughness in politics.
To absorb that narrative, like he got things done, is to absorb something that to accept a framework that we have simply been taught from birth, which is that politics is a hard knuckled game and you gotta be tough. And keep in mind that all of this is very tied up with ideas about masculinity, and particularly white masculinity, right? Mm-hmm. And that all of this happens within, a white patriarchy, a white capitalist patriarchy. But I think Cuomo is a test case for like, wait, can we try to disentangle our ideas about what effective power is, that it doesn't have to be mean, threatening, and scary necessarily. We see somebody who's a bully and very effective at intimidating people and say, wow, well, they really get the job done. And it feeds into ideas that we associate that's what power is to us, is somebody who's tough and mean. And I don't know that has to be the case. And I think we have to step back and question that. That's, I think, much closer to what Cuomo was. And it speaks to our own, the ways we've been taught to understand power, that we could so easily accept that as like, well, he's hard knuckled and he's our bully, and say that's what good leadership is. I actually think we need to question those assumptions.
Well, I haven't dismissed them, but I've questioned them and I've come up with this answer. I do think politics are a hard knuckle game that can't be well played by the untough. The advancement, and we've advanced on some of these issues and our definition of toughness, we now understand that men can be tough and women can be tough and black people can be tough and white people can be tough. So that white male part of it, I think we've definitely evolved past that. Not all of us have. But to succeed in politics, to actually get things done, I do think it involves pretty traditional notions of toughness. Bully? Well, bully is a charged and pejorative role, but if Jeffries and Schumer were leaning on Hochul, wouldn't you want someone who could lean back? At least someone to stand up to the bully? The lesson of Andrew Cuomo should be he shouldn't have sexually harassed, or maybe he shouldn't have opened himself up to sexual harassment charges, given all the enemies he made. That's definitely true. But the answer shouldn't be, and now we have to rethink everything we know about leadership, or we have to think that his accomplishments, and he had many, and Traister and others, I didn't play the whole clip, she downplayed his being first in the country on same-sex marriage, for instance, or New York State under his leadership. And he did that through toughness, and he did that through cajoling, and he did that through pretty blatant rewarding of his political allies by giving them judgeships after they were voted out of office for upstate New York districts. And he absolutely twisted arms. He toughed his way to that, and maybe we don't give him credit for that now because the rest of that country caught up, but that was a real accomplishment, as were those infrastructure accomplishments that Michael Kimmelman was talking about. We who follow politics, you perhaps among them, are not, if you think that toughness is important, you're not mistaken, you're not unevolved, you're not sexist, you're not benighted when you conclude that to get big things done, it takes resolve, perseverance, willingness to take the hits, ability to deliver them, the quality properly known as toughness. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of respecting the on-air light. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, Gpru, Dupru. Thanks for listening.